Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss, and I've been closely tracking the ETF space for more than 13 years through a variety of roles here at SeekingAlpha.com. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investing goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of the individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. Bit of brief housekeeping here. This will be the final episode of the year. I will not be doing an episode next week, the week between Christmas and New Year's. We'll be back the following week, the first week in January, with Dodd Kitsley of Davis ETFs. I want to wish all of our listeners happy holidays, happy new year. We'll see you in 2021.
For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the morning of Wednesday, December 9th, 2020. My guest today is Will Hershey. Will is the CEO and co-founder of Roundhill Investments, responsible for the company's indexing, research, and product development efforts. You may remember Will from episode 29 of this show, an episode titled Game On, the Case for Pure Play Esports Exposure. If you haven't already, I highly recommend you go back and give that a listen. Today, Will and I will be discussing the Roundhill Sports Betting and iGaming ETF, ticker symbol BETZ, B-E-T-Z, which launched in early June of this year. Before founding Roundhill in 2018, Will served as the head trader with Yorkville Capital Management, where he traded the firm's long-short equity fund and separate accounts, in addition to developing and maintaining a suite of more than 20 custom indexes. He attended Vanderbilt University, where he received a BA in economics. Anyway, welcome back to the show, Will.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great to be back.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's great to have you back. This is my favorite time of the year in terms of sports betting and gambling. I mean, in general, just because of sports, because I'm a huge football fan and this is kind of the business end of the season, but pretty psyched that I did make the playoffs in both of the fantasy football leagues that I'm in. I got the buy-in. One of them came down to a couple plays last night. So that was super exciting.
Is this a way to brag to your friends that listen to the podcast to sneak that in there?
Absolutely. Not only a way to brag to them, but a bunch of people in one of the leagues actually own DraftKings and some of the other stocks in your indexes. And at least a couple of them did not make the playoffs. So yeah, it's definitely maybe a not so humble brag there. So let's get right into it here. Last time we spoke about your firm's Roundhill Bitcraft Esports and Digital Entertainment ETF, ticker symbol NERD. Your ticker symbols are awesome, of course. The world was a totally different place last time we spoke, and you were putting the finishing touches on BETZ, the fund we're going to discuss today. First of all, congrats on a heck of a first 6 months for the fund. The performance has been absolutely phenomenal. I looked these numbers up 2 days ago, but the market hasn't moved that much since. Fund is up nearly 53% since launched in early June. Versus a really not too shabby 18% gain for the S&P 500 over the same period. So first of all, congrats on that. That's terrific.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, I think people and were kind of looking at us like we were crazy when we were getting the ball in motion for launching a sports betting fund earlier this year when the future of sports was uncertain. But as you mentioned, the NFL seems to be going off relatively without a hiccup. So we've been pleased with the performance.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure a team here and there, maybe the Broncos a few weeks ago when they were forced to play without an actual quarterback might take exception to that. But yeah, I agree. I'm actually surprised by how well it's gone, not only the NFL, but what baseball did also, kind of like the idea of a shorter season where games actually mean something. And basketball, obviously, very, very exciting. So yeah, it's gone off really, really well. And on a global scale, obviously, you know, soccer and some of the big tennis tournaments have also gone off really well. So definitely. So investors have definitely taken note of the fund. Also, you're solidly above $150 million in assets under management. And I wanted to get into specifically what this fund does. So as with NERD, you seem to be a fan of putting two different related concepts into fund names. In that case, it was esports and digital entertainment. In this case, it's sports betting and iGaming. First of all, how are you defining sports betting for the purposes of this fund? And then what is iGaming exactly?
Sure. So when we look at sports betting, I think in the broadest sense of the term, really it's the act of placing a wager on the outcome of an event. Typically, that's what we think of in terms of traditional sports betting. For our universe and the way we look at crafting the portfolio, it includes both brick and mortar sportsbook operators, but also online betting, which is really the shift that we're seeing taking place, not only in the short term right now, but over the long term, as we see kind of regulation roll out. In terms of iGaming, it's kind of an umbrella term for online gaming and online casino. And there you're looking at online slots, online blackjack, online poker. And iGaming is really interesting because, one, it offers typically higher margins than does sports betting, where you have, you know, the risk of, you know, pricing a line or a spread where the sportsbook actually takes risk. You know, iGaming and online blackjack, all based on an algorithm, very predictable in terms of revenues and margins. And really, when we look at what the fund is really trying to achieve, it's trying to capture the shift from physical to digital. There are some players within the current portfolio that are currently focused on brick and mortar, but really where we see this going, similar to the reason that we're bullish on esports and digital entertainment, is really this shift from physical to digital. Gambling is the world's largest form of entertainment. So you're looking at $500 billion in gross gaming revenues. About 10 to 15% of that as of last year was taking place online. We expect that to grow over time. And that's really the exposure, the beta exposure that we're interested in providing to our end investors.
And I guess just to dig into this a little further, you could cast your net kind of as widely as possible. What sorts of peripheral businesses or industries can be included in the sports betting and iGaming ecosystem in terms of capturing the theme for investors as thoroughly as possible?
Yeah, so the first one is the obvious one, and these are the B2C sportsbook operators. So you mentioned DraftKings. These are companies that are customer-facing, that operate either in-person or online sportsbooks where people can go, place a wager, and kind of enjoy the games that way. That's kind of the obvious and core part of the portfolio. Then on the iGaming side, you have B2C operators, and it's kind of a nuance there because different states and different countries have different rules, and I'm sure we'll touch on that in a second. You also have iGaming and sportsbook B2B providers, so kind of what we would call technology companies that are really providing back-end services to the companies that operate the front end. So just as an example, if you're in Pennsylvania, which is the only state that this is live in right now, and you're on Dave Portnoy's Barstool Sportsbook, the back end's actually operated by a company called Kambi out of Sweden. So those are kind of interesting companies that offer what we would kind of call like a picks and shovels type play on the industry, right? They're operator agnostic. They're trying to grab market share, and they'll grow as the industry grows. Then you have the traditional brick and mortar casino operators that are making a push into online. That's always what we're trying to get in terms of exposure. Those are companies that I think people are rather familiar with. Penn, once again, being a pretty interesting example there, as they're clearly making a shift from traditional brick and mortar casinos throughout kind of different regions within the US, now transitioning to kind of being more of an online story with the Barstool tie up. And then a final group that would kind of tie in here is actually lead generation. So kind of what you think of in terms of affiliate marketing is a very lucrative business, particularly due to the fact that on a country level, there's different regulations in terms of how you can actually acquire customers, on what platforms can you advertise, you know, betting platforms. And then actually one more that I'd mention that I think will end up probably being bigger over time is really, and you could bucket this under technology as well, but it is really data providers. So sports analytics and data providers that are providing data to the betting platforms is another group. So it's really kind of a diverse group of companies that makes up the basket. And whenever we're looking at a thematic portfolio, that's how you really, you know, create a basket that's really unique and different and doesn't necessarily consist of all growth stocks or value stocks or small cap or large cap. It's really kind of an amalgamation of these different factors into one.
Yeah, it's interesting. And we're definitely going to get into the index composition and you know, the index that underlies BETC a bit more later, because I'm sure listeners are going to want more details around how particular names are selected and you know, what the weighting scheme looks like, rebalancing, all that stuff. But before we get into that, I'd love to stay on the theme a bit longer here. So you launched this fund back in June. At that point, it really wasn't at all clear what professional or college sports was going to look like either in the US or abroad in the midst of a pandemic, and whether any of the major sports leagues were really going to happen both in the US and globally. First of all, did you ever think about maybe delaying the launch as a result of that? And then also, how do you explain Betts' incredible performance this year in light of what's clearly been a lower margin year for many professional sports leagues?
Sure. So I maybe we thought slightly about delaying the launch when it was, you know, in the doldrums of March when the world was falling apart. Yeah. But I think really when we look at this opportunity, it's really a long-term story that's going to take place over several years, if not decades. So we were pretty confident that the long-term thesis stayed in play, and we know better than to try and time the market. So from that perspective, we felt pretty good, all things considered. In terms of the performance, there's a few things going on, and it's really been an exciting industry over the past several months. I think the first is pretty straightforward, and what we're seeing in the U.S., in the states that are currently live, is all-time highs in terms of the amount wagered, the revenues for the operators in the various states. So New Jersey just hit an all-time record. Pennsylvania, Colorado, virtually every state that's up and running is seeing new all-time highs. And pretty much across the board, more than 90% of that is taking place digitally, which is really the core of this thesis. I think to a certain degree, a lack of in-person viewing has probably accelerated the growth and adoption of betting as kind of a way to feel like you're more engaged while you're watching the game than you would be if you were, you know, not on your couch. I think another thing kind of related to the pandemic is it feels like state by state legislation within the US, which is a major catalyst for this industry, is more likely. And I think when you look at the budget deficits that are in place in the wake of COVID-19, you know, you're starting to see more states take a look at, you know, cannabis legalization. I think the regulation and legalization of sports betting and at a later date, iGaming becomes somewhat of lower hanging fruit for states that are looking to bring in additional tax revenues. And I think the market's starting to appreciate various timelines may have been pulled forward. A couple other things that are really interesting that are going on. One is kind of consolidation within the industry and broad-based M&A. So Caesars in the process of acquiring William Hill, which is a popular sports book in the UK and the US. Flutter just last week announced they're increasing their stake in FanDuel. Evolution Gaming out of Sweden is buying Net Entertainment. So there's a lot of consolidation in M&A, and I think that's been a pretty big factor over the past several months. And then the last one I'd point to is we've seen various media partnerships and investments that I think really highlight the mainstream acceptance that sports betting in particular, much more so than iGaming, is going to have going forward within mainstream culture. And, you know, there you have NBC, which took a stake in PointsBet. You had a major media partnership deal between DraftKings and ESPN. Obviously, Penn, you know, having invested in Barstool. And I think what that's really setting up for is the integration of betting and sports betting and lines into mainstream media in a way that it's really going to become par for the course, integrated in everything from when you're watching a game in a year, you know, you're going to see the line on the bottom of the screen. And I think that's such a shift than what we saw even a year ago, where, you know, sports betting was kind of seen as taboo, you know, the pandemic's really accelerated mainstream adoption. So I think there's several factors going on, but kind of the biggest driver all in all is that the growth appears to be materializing maybe quicker than we had otherwise expected.
Yeah, that's super fascinating, actually. And I am hearing a lot of similarities to the cannabis space. You know, for example, when Constellation put a $5 billion investment into Canopy Growth Corporation, just kind of shows the wider adoption. And then you see this year's election, more and more states, and states that I think people would not have imagined would be legalizing cannabis are you know, they are on the front lines, states like the Dakotas. So yeah, really interesting to keep an eye on that. In terms of the legalization question, so I have a graphic here, which I think is actually on DraftKings website at sportsbook.draftkings.com. And it shows different color-coded representation, which states currently have legalized sports betting, which ones have considered legalizing but haven't yet, and which ones really have not even entered into the conversation. And I'm wondering, in terms of the long-term thesis to play out here, how much is it predicated on the fact that right now there's only 23 states in the U.S. with legalized sports betting? States like California and Texas, really, you know, gigantic states with humongous populations, have not legalizing this yet at this point. How much the longer-term thesis here is predicated on legalization happening in all 50 states? And how much is that almost immaterial to this being just a great long-term bet anyway?
Yeah, no, I think it's very important that we get to the point where more and more states are regulating this market. You know, it's funny because we're only less than 2 years from it becoming legal on a federal level with the repeal of PASPA in 2018. But when we look at the size of the unregulated black and kind of offshore market, it's massive. Like, we're talking about, you know, estimates vary, but over $100 billion a year in estimated wagers in the U.S. And long-term growth for the industry and for many of the companies in the portfolio is definitely predicated on eventually us moving towards more and more states. You mentioned a handful that are major catalysts if and when they come. I think it's really more when, not if. But you look at New York, you look at California, Florida, Texas, these are all going to be major catalysts when they roll through. You know, New York's an interesting example, and I think highlights how every single state legislature is different. In New York, you can bet on sports in person. You just can't do it mobily or online now. In California, you have tribal lands that control the casinos in that state. So there's a little bit of a different angle there. Every state is going to be really different, but you know, the U.S. rollout is certainly at the core of the thesis. And, you know, you're even seeing some of the legacy European iGaming and sports betting operators that are trying to get into the U.S. market because it's really the next area of growth for regulated betting and iGaming. iGaming is going to be critical as well. Once again, it's going to be state by state. It's going to be on different timeline than sports betting, but that's kind of going to be a long-term catalyst as well. And then, you know, there's more than just what's going on in the U.S. So just earlier this month, or I guess it was late last month, Canada introduced a bill that would legalize single event sports betting. Currently in Canada, you can only bet on parlays and kind of exotic bets. So Canada, we're now seeing regulatory momentum. Brazil is going to be another country to watch that could be really interesting. Even India. So I think when you're looking at, for us, the way we kind of view the long-term story here, the U.S. and regulation is kind of, it's just a question of when that will happen, but we believe it will. I think Utah is probably the state that will hold out the longest, if I had to guess.
It's probably a safe bet, yeah.
but it's very much a global story. And I think when you look to, you know, the U.K. and Australia and how they've benefited from a tax perspective by taking what's such a big black market and regulating it, it's kind of a win-win. And who knows how many more countries will kind of contribute to that growth, but that's going to just be, you know, provide additional tailwinds over the long term.
Yeah, sure. No, that makes a lot of sense. In terms of the demographics of this space, Are we talking about a younger population globally? What does the growth look like? How many people are currently participating in this on a global scale? And what are the projections for what the numbers can get to 5 or 10 years out?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Demographics, one thing I'd point out is that this is why I'm so bullish on iGaming in particular. Sports betting is dominated predominantly by male bettors. When you look at iGaming and online slots and online blackjack, the demographics completely change from a sex perspective. So females are you know, a little bit over 50%, I believe, of that market. In terms of the growth of the industry, the market coming into this year in terms of regulated online gambling was growing an estimated 10% per year over the past several years. I think that that's accelerated materially. We'll see when the numbers come in for this year. But once again, we're only talking about, you know, a penetration rate in terms of online's percentage of the total that's somewhere around 12%. So there's a lot of kind of shift that I think is expected to take place. When you look at age demographics that you point to, quite simply, you know, younger bettors are more attuned to placing bets digitally than older ones are. And I think that that bodes well for kind of the companies that are positioned to kind of take place of that digital transformation. In terms of the U.S. market, which I think is, once again, where a lot of the focus is, estimates are really all over the place because it's so difficult to try and capture these black market figures and what could eventually become regulated. But we're seeing 20 to 30 billion at maturity in gross gaming revenues on the betting side, another 30 plus in terms of iGaming. That might even be low given what we're seeing right now in states like New Jersey. And then in terms of number of participants, these numbers are difficult to kind of get a hold of. But if you want to kind of take an upside case, I mean, in the UK, over 50% of UK adults, and UK and Australia are known for being big gamblers and bettors, over 50% of adults gamble. And I think on a global basis, once again, you know, it's difficult to try and peg numbers here because of how much takes place in unregulated markets. But the TAM, if you will, and I don't want to go down the route of TAM because we're seeing too much of that in today's market, it is really significant. And long term, you kind of allude to this, really why we're so excited is this is kind of the gamification, if you will, of watching sports. And you know, for younger generations, I think just look at the demographic issues you're seeing in Major League Baseball. You know, how do you get younger people to pay attention to a slow game like baseball? Well, you introduce betting and you introduce live betting eventually, and you get people to feel like not only are they personally vested and involved, but they want to watch every single play. And I think sports are going to be, the future of sports is going to be very much so driven by betting. And I don't even think we've scratched the surface in terms of different ways that bets, as technology improves, that bets can be put out into the market. And it's really going to be interesting to see how that develops over time.
Yeah, sure. I do wonder in terms of in-person sports, and, you know, of course, this year has been really transformational in a good or positive way for many industries, obviously not been the case for many other industries, unfortunately. But I would imagine that, you know, of course, a lot of the growth happening this year will just kind of end up carrying forward as a change in people's behavior. They maybe weren't, you know, putting down bets on specific games or spending time, let's say, maybe playing poker online or blackjack or slots. And, you know, maybe it's something they do regularly now. I also wonder, though, if you just think about putting aside, let's say, people that actually have some kind of addiction problem and are spending money they don't have, the typical person probably, you know, doesn't even start falling into that category. It's very possible that with just the basic lack of entertainment outlets this year that I know myself in terms of my personal expenses, I can afford to go out and maybe buy a nicer bottle of scotch or a better cut of steak than I normally would, because I just, you know, the money's not getting spent on other things like live entertainment, which I used to spend, you know, a fair amount on. And I do wonder if that may be a bit of a future headwind when the pandemic finally ends. If you've already dropped several hundred dollars to attend a live sporting event, and you're not the kind of person that's going to spend money you don't have, I wonder if that suddenly means that you actually have less to spend on gambling than you've been spending during the pandemic.
No, it's certainly a great point. And I think you could look at it kind of both ways, right? So when live entertainment comes back, you're absolutely right that in theory, that takes a cut out of your quote unquote global entertainment spend. But kind of, you know, what I think has really happened and just kind of reiterating this is really we've seen, we've seen adoption and this goes well beyond this industry. I mean, look at things like e-commerce and industries where you already had a long-term growth rate in place, but what you've seen in 2020 is kind of a step up in what that growth rate looks like. And I think the question for a lot of these industries that have benefited from what's hopefully a short-term change in behavior necessitated by the pandemic is, you know, does the long-term growth rate now just simply increase? And I think that's what our thought is here is that, you know, you've gotten more participants involved. And quite frankly, I mean, when you look at, you know, the expectation for additional states in the U.S. to roll out, it's going to bring new bettors into the fold, and that's going to contribute to the growth. But, you know, once again, I think as the media continues to integrate betting more and more into broadcast, into, you know, kind of the way that they tell the story around games, it's just going to become more and more, you know, kind of likely for you to have even if you are at the game to throw $5, you know, just to make it feel a little bit more exciting and kind of really just falls into that entertainment bucket. So I think it's possible the same way if you look at e-commerce, is e-commerce going to have difficult comps in maybe 2021 or 2022? Certainly. But I think the long-term trend of a shift from physical to digital is taking place here. And I think that's really important to note is this industry doesn't necessarily need to grow for a lot of value to accrue to these newer companies. It just needs to shift from physical to digital. And I think that's more of a generational thing that's going to take place over several years than short term.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point for listeners to take note of, actually, as well as the point about, well, even if, I don't know, people in New Jersey bet 20% less, after the pandemic's over, but it gets legalized in California, that'll more than offset that, that trend there. So yeah, it's definitely worth keeping in mind.
With so many ETFs to choose from, how do you find the ones that are best for your portfolio? Personally, I always start my ETF searches with Seeking Alpha's ETF Screener, a product I came up with and helped build in 2015. Utilizing Seeking Alpha's proprietary ETF taxonomy system and powered by data from Morningstar and CapIQ, the ETF Screener now has a greatly improved user interface. Try the brand new data sliders, allowing you to create much more granular screens and locate the funds that best match your investing style and risk tolerance. I have personally built my own ETF portfolio, as well as my three kids' college saving plans and my parents' non-tax deferred ETF portfolios, starting with Seeking Alpha's ETF Screener each time. And what's best, Seeking Alpha's ETF Screener is totally free to use. So why not give the ETF Screener a try today by going to seekingalpha.com and typing the words ETF Screener into the search bar at the top of the site.
So I think this is probably a good place to pivot over to Betts' underlying index and the portfolio of the fund. What does the screening process look like in terms of ensuring pure play exposure? So for example, I play fantasy football on CBS, which is owned by Viacom, of course. It's a pay league. We have some very special settings. We have, you know, just kind of a really fun setup at this point. It involves multi-year transactions and players being kept over long-term periods. And so we're paying them money for this. This is clearly for the purposes of gambling. And yet Viacom's not in your portfolio for obvious reasons. Who knows what percent of the revenue comes from people playing fantasy on CBS? I imagine it's relatively small. So what are the basic screening characteristics here in terms of ensuring pure play exposure?
it sounds like you're in a dynasty league, and you're a much more sophisticated fantasy football player than I.
It's not full dynasty. It's there's a limited number of keepers, but yeah, there's definitely a dynasty element
to it. Sure. So in terms of what we're trying to achieve with bets, similar to what we've done in Nerd, really the goal is to once again provide that pure play beta exposure to the industry, and we follow a similar process whereby each quarter, when we're coming up on a rebound, we perform a screen of company filings for keywords that we've determined are relevant to the theme. So sports, online sportsbook or sports betting or online casino. And really that screen provides us with kind of a slimmed down universe that, and then dictates which companies make it into the portfolio alongside some qualitative analysis. And ultimately, I think the way we've constructed is with a focus on sports betting and iGaming being secondary. We're also incorporating a liquidity overlay. You know, if you go outside of the U.S., particularly into Sweden, where many of these names are traded, some of them aren't as liquid as what we see in the U.S., although they're very interesting companies and provide exposure. So we have a liquidity overlay. And then finally, we're going to assign pure play, core, or non-core classifications to each of the company within the initial screen. And provided that liquidity is there, we're going to weight pure plays higher. And we think that ends up creating a portfolio that really provides that beta exposure, unlike what you typically see with market cap weighted indexes, where to your point, if you had Viacom in a portfolio like this and market cap weighted it, you really would be getting a lot of other stuff. And that's really what we try to avoid. We want a portfolio that, insofar as there's positive catalysts and growth for this industry, it's going to benefit.
Yeah, certainly. And you're picking themes here that it's actually possible to do that with. Like, for example, you know, there's some very interesting blockchain funds out there. But the reality is, you put Facebook in a blockchain fund, how much exposure to blockchain are you getting? Like almost none. So, you know, I understand why they're there, but it's, you're actually able to do that effectively and properly here. So that's good to note. In terms of the rebalancing or the reconstitution, there's obviously some subjectivity on your part going on here, which is part and parcel of most indexes, of course, from the biggies like the S&P 500, where they might just decide, we don't feel like putting Tesla in, even though they meet all the qualifications this year, to you know, indexes like yours also. So how often are you rerunning that process? How often are names being added or removed from the index? And granted, I know that it's still early innings for the index, but just in terms of what the schedule for doing that is going forward.
Sure. So we're doing that on a quarterly basis. I think as the industry matures, you know, there won't be as much in the way of moving parts. But what we've seen is several new companies coming public, quite frankly. I mean, you have several SPACs right now that are in the process of acquiring sports betting or iGaming companies. DraftKings, famously, you know, arguably one of the best performing SPACs we've seen since this recent SPAC boom. GAN recently listed in the U.S.
SPACs or just publicly traded companies, period, over since it listed.
Yeah, no, exactly. So I think that's driven maybe a little bit more turnover than you'd typically find in an index fund. But, you know, that's really what we want to try and do is if there's new companies that are really providing this exposure, we want to be sure they're in the portfolio. And that's kind of the approach that we've taken. And then I mentioned earlier, you know, there's been a lot of M&A that's impacted the index as well. So typically on a quarterly basis is the way we're going to approach it.
Nice. And any idea how much turnover you expect? I guess it really does just vary based on what's happened in the previous quarter.
It does just vary. You know, we're also trying to capture, you know, companies that are making a broader shift into online betting and that stuff kind of takes place over a longer time frame. But, you know, I think if you look at the last rebalance we did, it was two or three additions to the index. I think that's probably where we expect to come out over the long term. But once again, as it matures, I think, and you find out which companies are going to be public at the end of the day, that's really what we're trying to do is provide exposure, not try and, you know, take into account recent market moves or anything like that.
Yeah, sure. And then in terms of the weighting methodology here, you hinted at pure plays versus non-pure plays being weighted differently, but you weren't overly specific. Is this some kind of modified cap weighting? Is it equal weighting? When let's say a new fund enter, sorry, when a new name enters the index and then the portfolio, what size is it entering at, and what kind of rebalancing is being done?
Yeah, so I guess we'd call it kind of tiered weight. Pure plays are getting 1.5 times the weightings of cores that are getting 1.5 times the weightings of non-cores as we have them classified based on our screening. So, you know, a new company that qualifies as a pure play will be, you know, in theory, if they're liquid enough, amongst one of the largest holdings in the portfolio. So just because it's new doesn't mean it's going to be, you know, scaled into over time per se.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right, so let's get into some of the specific holdings here. I'd love to just kind of start at the top, and that is PointsBet Holdings, which is an Australian bookmaker with U.S. subsidiaries. What do investors need to know about this company?
Sure. So that's exactly right. PointsBet is an online sportsbook operator, so similar to FanDuel Sportsbook or DraftKings Sportsbook, if people are more familiar there. But really, they've built their platform in Australia. They're now rolling it out into the U.S. And I think the growth story there has really become that of the U.S. and not the Australian market. How do they differ from some of their peers? And I think this is going to be really interesting because you're going to have to find ways, if you're a sportsbook operator, to kind of differentiate amongst what's your offering, right? So if you look at Penn National and Barstool, you know, they have Dave Portnoy and Big Cat to kind of promote different interesting bets within their platform. PointsBet has really interesting points betting technology, it's called. Actually, that's how they named the company, where you can place bets that are almost like, if I had to make an analogy to the market, it's almost like using leverage, where, you know, if you're betting on a given game using points betting, and you're betting on team A, the amount that team A beats team B by or loses by will dictate the amount of your win or loss. And they're the only ones that have this out in the market. And it's pretty unique and revolutionary technology that they've been able to include. I think one other thing for people to know on PointsBet is the partnership they have with NBC. So over the coming, you know, this should be rolled out pretty soon, but on any NBC sports broadcast, or for most of them, you're going to see PointsBet featured throughout everything, on the commercials, on the screen. And that's part of this really broad deal they've done together, where NBC took almost a 5% stake in PointsBet earlier this year. And they have, NBC actually has the option to increase that up to 25%. So PointsBet is going to be featured prominently throughout all of NBC sports offerings. And I think to that extent, it's certainly a possibility that they end up, you know, within the top five, within the top 10, certainly in market share when the dust settles. And that's one last thing I don't think we've touched on, is there's going to be room for several winners in this story. If you just look to Europe as kind of a template, you know, there's dozens of European online sportsbooks and iGaming operators that have, you know, decent market share. And I think, you know, PointsBet's a really interesting one. That's a pure play if you're looking to get involved in online sportsbooks.
Sure. And their unique technology there, where, you know, depending on different outcomes, you win or lose different amounts. Sounds like the kind of thing that serious options traders would maybe want to get into, where they're looking at different outcomes and, you know, straddling different types of positions. So yeah, definitely interesting, and something I'm going to check out more after this.
It's funny. I would almost call them, like, if you wanted to make some analogies to brokerage trading, and I think you can in a lot of ways, uh-huh. I call PointsBet almost like interactive brokers and DraftKings is Robin Hood.
Nice.
If I can make that analogy.
yeah. That's great. All right. So moving over to number two here, Flutter Entertainment. I was actually not immediately familiar with the name when I saw it, but the second I looked it up, everybody has heard of some of their subsidiaries, some of the names in their portfolio. We're talking Paddy Power, Betfair, Poker Stars, the site I used to play on back in the day, as well as decent size ownership of FanDuel. What do investors need to know about this company? They seem to really be kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Are they the biggest company in terms of revenue in this space right now?
they are the biggest. And you mentioned PokerStars. They bought, they acquired PokerStars in a deal that closed earlier this year. Once again, more M&A that we didn't even touch on. But no, Flutter is really kind of the diversified player and giant in the room, to your point, on a kind of on a global basis when it comes to online betting and iGaming. Interesting you mentioned FanDuel. They actually just last week increased their stake in FanDuel. So I think they had somewhere around 60% coming into this. They increased it to 95% based on their current investment here. FanDuel is valued at $11.2 billion. Which interestingly is well below, last I checked anyway, well below DraftKings value in the current market. But at the same time, FanDuel is the number one online sportsbook in the US. They have over 40% share, bigger than DraftKings, and are trading, you know, at a lower valuation. So clearly an attractive investment for them to kind of up their stake there. And I think, you know, kind of we talked about some analogies to be made versus the cannabis industry, but in a lot of ways this is different, in the sense that a lot of these companies, particularly those with European and UK-based operations, are profitable. So, you know, Flutter is a profitable company that happens to have FanDuel, which is not profitable quite yet, to my understanding, but focused more on growth in the portfolio. So, you know, Flutter trades at 30 to 40 times earnings. They have 20% EBITDA margins. Their UK and Australia business are you know, putting out positive cash flows that they can then use to fund their US business. So Flutter, all in all, is a very interesting company and a way to get exposure to a lot of these different growth segments and regions. It'll be interesting to see if they potentially take a look at spinning off their FanDuel stake, because what we're seeing, just looking at DraftKings as an example, is there's really a valuation arbitrage, if you will, from, you know, non-US markets and US markets. And what I mean by that is the multiples that are being assigned to US listed iGaming and sports betting companies is simply much higher. There could be an interesting opportunity for Flutter to spin off FanDuel onto the US exchanges and capture some of that value.
I mean, that would certainly offer a good explanation for why they just upped their stake from 60 to 95%. And yeah, I was just taking a look at DraftKings here on Seeking Alpha Quill page. We're talking about a market cap of just under $20 billion. We're talking about a company that's also not earnings positive at this stage. Again, they're still in growth mode. I think it's probably safe to assume that part of the reason that companies that are focused on the US market in the sports betting or iGaming space are trading at these kinds of lofty valuations is that, again, you've only got 23 states with legal sports betting of any type at all. And as you mentioned, there's major states like New York where you need to be doing it in person. And so if you look at the demographics there, the multiple, you know, assuming that you're legal in places like California and New York digitally and Texas and other key states where it is not yet legal, five or so years out from now, you know, these multiples, as crazy as they look, might actually be really underestimating the long-term valuations of these companies here.
No, it's certainly possible. And I think, you know, DraftKings, which you mentioned, is kind of in a growth at all costs type mode. And I think to a certain degree, you know, that type of business strategy throughout the market right now is being rewarded. You know, from last quarter alone, and this is astounding to me, you know, DraftKings spent over $200 million on marketing and advertising in a quarter. That's more than 10 invested into Barstool for their stake. And it's just indicative of this model of grow at all costs, but it's worked for DraftKings. So just as of last month, they actually took over as number one in online casino and iGaming in the US. As I mentioned, FanDuel is number one in online sports betting, DraftKings number two, but the market's rewarding that kind of, you know, top line growth, that user growth that we've seen from DraftKings. I'd be interested to see to what degree they can maybe take advantage of their, you know, high-priced currency to be acquisitive. We've already seen them, you know, raise secondary capital. I think they've raised over $1 billion in secondaries this year that they can then use to pump back into that, you know, marketing and advertising machine. But I wouldn't be surprised if they look to be acquisitive with their currency. I mean, I talked about the valuation arbitrage. You know, you can look at you know, high quality or decent growing European iGaming sports betting companies that are trading at, you know, below 12 times EBITDA, below 10 times EBITDA even. I wonder if DraftKings looks to do that to kind of bring some earnings power into the company.
Be definitely very interesting to keep an eye on that. In terms of DraftKings, it's had really just an incredible run since IPOing, really, I guess, less than a year before you opened the fund, really just a year and a half ago, a little less than that. You know, this is a company that went from, I think it was $10 a share when it IPO'd to above 60 in early October. It's pulled back a little bit, and yet the stock is still up, you know, fairly huge amounts since its IPO. And I'm just wondering what your outlook is for DraftKings at the current price, and also in terms of rebalancing of the portfolio, is there any ability to kind of trim the winners and you know, redouble down on the losers? How does that look in terms of the actual management of the ETF?
Yeah, so I, you know, in terms of outlook, it's very difficult to try and project, sure. As we all know. I mean, I think once again, you know, DraftKings is getting rewarded by the market for the fact that it's seen as kind of the large cap or mid cap, however you want to look at it, pure play way to play U.S. only sports betting. And as a result, it's getting a fancy multiple and tremendous performance. You know, I'm an old school valuation guy and think it has some work to do to grow into that valuation. But once again, what I just mentioned, I think there's opportunities for them to be tactical and smart and do things like an acquisition or even additional secondary that continues to, you know, pull forward growth for the company. In terms of our management of the index, we're not going to look to try and, you know, reduce positions upon rebalance based on potential recent price performance. But we have, you know, as a result of, you know, the fact that we're doing it once a quarter, just by nature of the way our methodology works, we will typically see like our top several positions be reweighted lower. We saw that with PointsBet that, you know, when NBC made that announcement, you know, it was up 80% in a day, and then come the next rebalance, we trim that. So that would be how we would look to kind of keep the portfolio from getting too overweight a single position.
Yeah, sure. That makes total sense. So I want to get into the only other ETF that probably serves, I think, as a direct comparison to Bets. That's the VanEck Vectors Gaming ETF, BJK. This is obviously an important thing for investors to consider. You want exposure to a space. There's more than one option available. You know, what's the right choice? First of all, in terms of performance, Bets has just absolutely crushed it. So you've got a 6-month window at this point to measure. And Bets is up 53% versus 23% for BJK. That's not bad. I mean, it's beat the S&P 500 by 5% over that 6-month period, but still obviously not the kind of performance that your fund has produced. Your fund is a little pricier than BJK. So we're talking 75 basis points for 66 basis points for BJK. In terms of the holdings, there's definitely significant overlap there. BJK's top holding is Flutter Entertainment. It's also got DraftKings as its fourth largest holding. There's also some significant differences, though. They seem way more focused on brick and mortar.
Yep.
Casinos, for example, probably in terms of weighting, I'm guessing less of a focus on sports betting, more of a focus on just straight up casino style games and such, both of the digital and in-person variety. What are some key differences there that you think investors need to keep an eye on?
I mean, I think you highlighted it maybe better than I even could, but that's exactly what I see as the main difference. You know, the way we view Bets is over time, it's really going to shift to be digital first and online focused companies, whether that's sports betting or iGaming. As far as I'm aware, the VanEck product really is kind of focused on anything involved and classified under casinos and gaming. And as a result, you know, it's performed well, as you mentioned, over the past several months, but is really leveraged to brick and mortar casinos that are really have in a lot of ways have really become kind of part of this reopening trade. And I think over the long term, I can't speak that as to how they'll be managing their index or portfolio. But for us, you're going to get a focus on online simply because this is the long-term trend we're excited about. It's the shift from physical to digital. It's what younger people, the way they want to engage in content. And that's what how we're going to manage ours. I think really the brick and mortar exposure that you're going to find in bets over time will be limited to companies that are explicitly trying to make the shift to digital and have a focus on these growth areas.
Yeah, sure. And it's reminds me of a conversation I had on this show with Christian Magoon of Amplify, where he was making a similar case about his IBUY ETF, which is a retail fund, which simply has a full exclusion for physical brick and mortar retail locations, only focuses on digital. It has just absolutely trounced, focus on e-commerce has absolutely trounced, you know, the equivalent of funds like RTH and XRT, which have a mix of, you know, for every Amazon or Etsy in their portfolio, they've got a Macy's or a Nordstrom's also. That obviously hasn't been a winning strategy over the last decade. So, and I guess I should disclose, I'm long a similar fund, eBiz, which is also an online or e-commerce only retail fund. It just, you know, normally it's difficult to predict markets, but I don't think you need any kind of particular crystal ball to look out and say, obviously, I want to overweight or just eliminate, I want to overweight companies that are doing digital business because that's where the world is heading and it makes total sense here also and kind of eliminate the dinosaurs and just there's no reason to continue to invest in companies that are presiding over a shrinking market share and less potential consumers for what they're doing.
I'm with you. I'm with you there. No question about it.
Nice. I mean, I almost wonder, you do have iGaming in the title. I almost wonder if, but it's almost, you know, somewhat hidden. And I wonder if maybe the word digital or something, if it would make sense to maybe get that into the title of the fund to just make clearer to potential investors. This is of course, a suggestion that maybe came a little too late considering the funds.
Are you suggesting our fund name isn't long enough? Because we can make it a lot.
Yeah. Or maybe you could have gone with something like IBET for the ticker.
There you go.
But
I like that.
The I thing is totally overdone, I guess, but seems to keep on working for people. So, all right. I guess just... could you get into one more holding in the portfolio that maybe is unfamiliar to U.S.-based investors? So much of the portfolio is not even traded in the U.S. Just curious if there's one name that you think should be on people's radars that you feel has a real chance to drive the performance of bets going forward.
Sure. I'll throw out what I think I would call a FinTwit or financial Twitter favorite. Which is Kambi, a Swedish listed company spun off from Kindred, which is also in the portfolio. And Kambi, once again, is one of these B2B technology providers. They're going to grow and are very exposed to the U.S. growth story, despite being listed in Sweden. You know, some of their clients are Rush Street, Penn, Barstool, and they're really kind of you know, this interesting play that. You know, they're the ones that are running the backend technology that these front-facing sportsbook apps run on, but they don't necessarily care which one of their end clients wins insofar as the overall pie grows. So they're an interesting one to keep an eye on.
Nice. That's great. All right. Anyway, it's been awesome, Will. Thanks so much for coming back on the show. We're definitely going to have to get you on again relatively soon because I think we share a lot of interests and your funds are really fun. And also the performance has been terrific. So definitely a good thing to bring in front of listeners so they can consider getting in at the ground floor, so to speak, because it sounds like even if it, you know, some of these some of the performances seem difficult to fathom, up 50% in a year. You know, if the long-term growth is there, that really can end up being a drop in the bucket if you think in terms of decades and not years.
No, absolutely. And we have more funds hopefully planned for the first quarter of next year. So I'd love to come back.
Nice. Anything you can hint at right now, or if not, I totally get it also.
I'm in a quiet period, but the filing is out on the SEC's website. I think that's about all I'm allowed to say.
Gotcha. Okay. So should be fairly easy to figure that out then. For listeners that want to keep on researching what we've been discussing here, learn more about your funds, where do you recommend they go?
I think the best place to go is our website, and you can sign up for our newsletter that we put out every weekend covering our sector. So that's roundfulinvestments.com. Otherwise, if you want to be a little more passive, you can follow us on Twitter as well, where we try and share interesting news, salient points, research that we're finding interesting. And our account there is @roundhill. So either of those would work. Anyone that wants to get in touch with me personally or our team is more than welcome to do that as well.
Nice. And then you have a personal Twitter account that I follow also, which you put out some great stuff on, and got a lot of followers, very active there. You want to tell people what your handle is in case they want to follow you personally also?
Sure. I don't know why they would pick me over the firm's account, but if they
could pick both, can't they? There's no limit on how many people you can follow.
That's true. I'm only kidding. My Twitter handle is fun. It's @maybebullish. And I think this year I should have just had it say bullish, but maybe bullish.
That's good. And also, I like that it's not your name. My Twitter handle is also not my name, Giant ETF Fisher. I set that up probably 15 years ago at this point and had no idea that I was actually going to be using it professionally in any way, shape, or form. But good to see that there's still people out there that get creative with the handles and don't just write their name like everyone
else. Absolutely. You got to have fun with it.
You do. Anyway, well, this has been awesome. I want to wish you a really great holiday season. Much luck in the new year. And of course, while we ride out the rest of this storm here, safety and health and sanity and really only good things.
Absolutely. Same to you. Thank you so much for having me again.
For disclosures, Will Hershey is long, BETZ and NERD. I, Jonathan Liss, am long, EBIZ. If you've been enjoying Let's Talk ETFs, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you find this podcast useful, please consider leaving a review on one of those platforms so that other investors can discover it. You can also find this podcast on SeekingAlpha.com by typing Let's Talk ETFs into the search bar at the top of the site.